This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, a possible acquisition for the Bismarck Tribune and what that could mean for the state of local journalism. But we are going to start today with the new book, Coming to America, An Immigrant's Story. And it says here, experienced and written by Klaus Lemke, who joins me now from the Bismarck studio. Klaus, thanks for joining us today.
Well, glad to be here. Thank you, Ashley.
I love that. Experienced and written by Klaus. I suppose that's what a memoir should be, your experiences.
Well, that's what I thought. Nobody coached me on that. And I said, well, I wrote it and I experienced it.
Why did you want to write a memoir?
Mainly for my children. You know, I have three grown-up children now. And it's a different life in Germany, born in 1942. It's just an interesting life that I wanted to share with them. That was the original intent. And it just grew and grew into more, but that was their original purpose.
What do they know about this time? Because as we know, this is the World War II era, a very difficult time to be, well, anywhere in the world, but, you know, Germany, Poland, France, those areas particularly hard hit, Japan as well.
Well, the thing that I, in my research and talking to my parents over their experiences towards the end of the World War, I found out that there were truly difficult times and scary times.
Yeah.
My parents told me in the early 40s, 30, 43, 44, they knew, everybody in Germany knew it was over. It was not winnable. Everything was in short supply, you know, and the fuel, the food, housing, you know, the war was in full force. Mm-hmm. But the authorities wouldn't let it go. You would be punished or able-bodied people would be pressed in service if you tried to flee or get away from there.
Yeah, you talk about your dad getting into a fatal altercation with an SS officer, ended up killing him in this process.
Yeah, that's true. And I found that out years later when my dad was over here in Bismarck on a visit. But they rarely talked about that. I remember talking to my mom about, you know, you've seen all we hear about those cattle cars, you know, full of mm-hmm. people and supposedly be sent to concentration camp. Didn't you see that? Didn't you hear that? And my mom said, well, we lived in northern Germany. There's no industry. There are no known Jewish people living up there. And it's an area north of Hamburg up to Denmark. And she said, but you got to remember that everybody was so poor after the war during the end of the war that everybody traveled in cattle cars. It was a fine way to get from place to place. Just hop on, and the railroad people didn't object to that. So it was not unusual to see families huddled in a cattle car just to go to another town.
You know, my family is Swedish, Norwegian, and Finnish. We're not particularly known for being very open, particularly about emotions. I think they say that oftentimes of Germans. How hard was it for you to get stories like this from your parents to pass on to your children?
It was difficult. I've had aunts and uncles that helped me with that because after that conversation with my mom that one time about the cattle cars, she said, please, don't ask me that kind of a question ever again. I think there was obviously guilt in her that she couldn't talk about it.
Yeah. What about from your father or maybe some of your uncles? You mention in the book that they were members of the Nazi Party.
Yeah, it was interestingly enough that my uncle did talk about that, and they were, like the rest of the country, so enthusiastic and so hopeful about something new coming on and work, you know, and prosper and building highways and getting jobs. They just got, in my opinion, they got swept up into that. Dad never could talk about that. The only time he ever told me about that SS officer was when he was over here. But he was still, I remember the first time he was over here and when we lived in Fargo, he was meek and quiet, and he's anything but a meek and quiet person. He was in enemy territory. He's still looking at the U.S. as an enemy, you know.
Hmm. Yeah, you just said Dad being thought of as meek, and in other parts of the book he's strict, and I would argue, and a lot of people I think would say maybe even abusive at times.
Yes, he was. Yeah, I guess you have read the book in detail, Ashley. That is true, and a couple of my brothers have never forgiven him for that. Mm. You know, I don't know. With me, it just. Love just overcame all that, and I had some great times with my dad after he retired and after I was an adult and over here in the U.S.
Well, let's talk about that journey to the United States. You were doing farming in Germany. You met a relative who had come to the U.S. many years earlier and had been working on farms in Wolverton, Minnesota, which is south of the Fargo-Moorhead area, just a few minutes here. Why did you want to come to the United States?
Well, Dad was a farmer, and after he lost his farm in what we called West Prussia, he managed farms. There were so many farm families that lost the male person in their family, and they needed somebody to manage the farm. So Dad did that after the war for several places, and that got me going and created the desire that I wanted to be a farmer. So I lived with that. I went to school with that. I went to ag college with that. And while I was in ag college, Dad quit farming. And Mom had built a dry cleaning and laundry business that was flourishing. And so he quit farming. And there I was with a farm degree and no place to go.
Mm.
That's when I learned about this uncle. It is ironic that he was part of the group that were developing the Hillsboro sugar beet plant.
Mm.
And he was sent on behalf of sugar beet farmers to Germany to negotiate the building of that plant in Hillsboro. And that's where I met him. And it turned out that he had a farm in Wolverton and no kids.
Ah, okay. Well,
lighthearted Norwegian can figure that out. There's the potential, you know. And he made no bones about it. He says, I can't give you a guarantee, but yeah. If you come over, let's give this a try. And boy, was I excited.
And then you get here expecting this very modern approach to farming. And what you found instead was?
It was still old-fashioned in many ways behind what I had experienced in Germany. I was very surprised by that. You know, like I said in the book, they had a smaller tractors and smaller equipment. And I think that growth spurt of farming, the style of farming, that didn't really happen until the mid to late 60s.
Hmm. Well, and you write, too, in the book about the work hours here. I spent some time living in France, and it was very difficult for me to get used to a two-hour lunch break because I'm used to, like, a 15-minute lunch while you eat kind of thing, and I would get so bored on my lunch break because the stores were closed, the post office. You know, I couldn't do anything on this lunch break. And you talk about the difference in the hours of farmers between Germany and then the hours that you worked when you got here.
It was awful. I really had to get adjusted to that. You know, we quit at 6 o'clock, like I say in the book. But here they farm until it's too wet to combine or too dark to plow. I mean, it was. And then the poor woman of the house, they had to sit there with their food and wait until 8 or 9. And then one thing was even worse than that. Many, many times, and many, many people, they did stop at the liquor store on the way home.
I bet. Yeah, the French have this saying, you know, that the French work to live and Americans live to work.
Oh, boy, I've not heard that before. It took a few years to adjust to that, but I did. You know, once it's your own, it is a little easier. Mm. When I was first here, I was a hired man. And then yeah. You work all those long hours for what? For the same salary, you know, 150 a month. But once you're the owner, I can understand where you wouldn't mind working endless hours.
And then you also brought some of that energy, those hours, into working real estate. What drew you from farming to real estate?
Well, we had to move off the farm, of course, once my uncle died. And I'd looked for opportunities here and there, and I worked for some a produce department that produced sunflowers and peanuts and peanut butter and stuff like that. But there was I was already a second in command, and there was no future, and I looked for something better. And a friend of mine, his dad was in real estate, and so I thought I'd give that a try. And I liked that. Even so, I struggled for about 3 years. I didn't do real well.
Well, yeah, at the time, I think your command of English maybe wasn't what it is right now. Is that, am I remembering correctly?
Oh, that is correct. When I studied, I had trouble studying for the test, the real estate examination test. But it did help me in a small way, too, because when I met people at open houses or whatever, and they couldn't remember my name, they called the real estate company up and they would say, that German fellow there.
Yes, you became quite memorable, then going on to serve as what's affectionately, you've been dubbed the King of Burley County, a longtime county commissioner. So now we have this layer of what drew you to elected office.
There are a couple of friends that really not happy with being called the king of, they didn't, we're a democracy. I was told by two people not to push that.
But so, what drew you to want to serve?
I've always, this is my country. I want to have a hand in it, no matter how small. I was interested in what went on. Where's the new street going in there? Are we growing? Are we, you know, what can we do here? Can we? And I also wanted to serve. And that's what made me look at public service. I did run for city commissioner once in Fargo, and I don't know if you know the history, but I came in on 14th place. But there was a consolation prize. There was one guy in 15th place. And for some of your listeners that remember, his name was Torfin Tigan. There'll be a few people that remember him.
Okay. You know, it strikes me as interesting that you just said when I asked you why you want to serve in elected office, and you said, this is my country. Now, of course, you weren't born here. You're a naturalized citizen, and then you became a U.S. citizen. You've raised your family here, your wife and your three children? Yeah, three children. And talking about this immigrant status, and you call it an immigrant's story. And I remember being a little bit surprised the first time that I heard that Germans from Russia, those people were really persecuted when they came to the United States following World War II, because, of course, Germany was the bad guys in World War II. And I'm wondering what parallels you see now to the way that immigrants from other countries are being treated. And do you hope that there might be that same level of surprise? Like, why are we so scared of people from this country now? Because now you wouldn't think anything of a German immigrant.
No, or any immigrant. I think we all don't mind any immigration people coming over here as long as they experience and want to experience the same love for this country as we all do that are here. I think we really don't have a problem with that. The maybe other parts of the world, but the objections that I have is that the federal government dictates who is going where. Why couldn't I testified before the county when that issue was I was not a county commissioner then, but I testified for it. Why wouldn't the county be asked how many can you take? How many can you easily support? Because they need support. They needed help. And that I think is the complaint. When you really dig into it, nobody really objects to immigrants, but everybody objects to the federal government telling us when and what and how many to take.
You know, there's an interesting part of your book where before you decide to run for election at all, you ask yourself, am I a Democrat or a Republican? And it almost sounds funny because most people seemingly have a pretty strong identity one way or the other. And And as you go through the reasons that in some ways you identified with Democrats and in some ways you identified with Republicans, ultimately became very active in the Republican Party. But what was interesting about that part of the book is that you focus at least a little bit on how much overlap there really is between those two. And kind of like what you just said, it's more so a matter of how to enact a policy more than a difference on who's impacted by the policy. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's a very nice summary of how I feel about it. You're absolutely correct. I think the Democrats have just as bigger intention to making this country great. It's just the approach is different, and I feel more comfortable with the conservative nature of the Republican Party. And hey, the Republican Party is not all always correct either. We could, in my opinion, we could be a little more conservative. We have a tendency to kind of slip on that too.
In the book, you mention that you're friends with Nicole Poolman, state senator, who recently announced that she will not be seeking re-election. And one of her main reasons is because of this disintegration of discourse within the state legislature. Now, I know that a county commissioner is not the same thing as a state legislator, but I'm just curious how you feel about hearing your friend go through something like that.
I was obviously very disappointed. I was there from the start. The very first time she ran for office, I was the new district chairman in the new district where she ran for office, and it was between the two of us who would go for the Senate seat. And at that time, I was 70 years old, and I said, no, we need younger people. And I endorsed her race, and I did the right thing. She is a wonderful legislator and brought a lot of good ideas to the Senate, and I'm very sorry to see her go.
Klaus Lemke is the author of Coming to America, An Immigrant's Story. Thank you so much for your time today.
Well, Ashley, it was great to visit with you.
Coming up next on Main Street, a remembrance of the poet Robert Bly.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck and dedicated to producing reliable electricity. Basin Electric operates generation stations in North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming, including wind projects in North and South Dakota.
Lydia Bastianic explains how her family left Yugoslavia.
My father had to escape. The dogs were chasing him, he was shot at, and he made it.
Martin Fletcher writes a new novel about Israel.
How do you found a nation? You know, how do you do that? So that's what the book is about.
And learn to be a Greek godmother.
It's really to be like a confidant, somebody that they can turn to if whatever their problems are.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tomorrow at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Poet Robert Bly has died. He was a tireless advocate of his art form, which over the course of half a century transformed American poetry. He was also central to the controversial men's movement. He passed away on Sunday at age 94. Here's a report that aired on yesterday's All Things Considered from Minnesota Public Radio's Ewan Kerr.
Robert Bly could rub people the wrong way.
I do remember people wanting to kill me, but that's not unusual.
That was the poet from an interview in 2010. He was a brash farm boy from southern Minnesota who served in the Navy, then went to Harvard with the likes of poet Donald Hall and author George Plimpton. After graduating in 1950, he tired of East Coast life. First, he got an MFA at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and then returned to farm life in the town of Madison, Minnesota.
The small world of the car plunges through the deep fields of the night. On the way from Wilmer to Milan, this solitude covered with iron moves through the fields of night, penetrated by the noise of crickets.
Bly launched a literary magazine with his friend William Duffy called The 50s. In the first issue, they laid out their manifesto, Quote, "The editors of this magazine think that most of the poetry published in America today is too old-fashioned." In 1999, Bligh said they got submissions from some of the best-known poets of the time, but rejected almost all of them.
Bill was a genius at these rejection slips. He'd say things like, "Dear Mr. Jones, these poems remind me of false teeth. Yours sincerely, William Duffy." And then we'd get insulting letters back, and we'd print the letters because they had more excitement and energy in them than the poems.
The magazine did print poems by Gary Snyder, Denise Levertov, Allen Ginsberg, and James Wright, as well as Bligh's translations of poets largely unknown to U.S. audiences, Pablo Neruda, Federico Garcia Lorca, and Antonio Machado, among many others. The 50s also published Bligh's own poems, and daughter Mary watched her father polish some of them for years.
You write a poem, you put it in a trunk, you pull it out a year later, you rewrite it intensely for 2 weeks, you put it back in the trunk. You're bringing months and years of your life to bear on the one idea that turns into 16 lines.
Robert Bligh won the National Book Award in 1968 and became a very public advocate for poetry. Writer Jim Lenfesty organized a 2009 conference called Robert Bligh in This World to explore the poet's influence.
He really changed the way poetry is read and heard in America.
Bligh also studied the deeper meanings of fairy tales and the roots of gender roles in modern society. The two came together in 1990 in Iron John, a book about men. Bligh used a tale from the Brothers Grimm to argue that society disconnects men from their deep feelings and emotions, and that causes problems for everyone.
There's a tremendous amount of belittling of men that has been going on for a long time in our culture.
The book spent 62 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list and became a focus for the nascent men's movement. It attracted huge media attention, but also got slammed as being anti-women. Bligh and his supporters denied this, and he kept writing into his 80s.
That's what it feels like when you get to be my age. Each of us deserves to be forgiven, if only for our persistence in keeping our small boat afloat, when so many have gone down in the storm.
For NPR News, I'm Ewan Kerr in Minneapolis.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Eat Your Heartland Out, a show all about the food and culture of the American Midwest. I'm your host and tour guide, Capri Cafaro. In this series, we go beyond the stereotypes of flyover country to explore the untold tales of the region. We are drinking our way through the Midwest with hard cider. We will travel to Michigan to fill our glasses with cider production knowledge. And then it's off to Wisconsin, where we will visit with an apple producer at the core of Wisconsin cider making and a young cider maker who's at the cutting edge of developing new cider flavors. All this and more on Eat Your Heartland Out.
Eat Your Heartland Out, coming up tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
Still to come on Main Street, a possible acquisition facing the Bismarck Tribune and a natural North Dakota essay. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota's congressional delegation has been asked to investigate the case of a farmer with ties to the state who is believed to be in a prison in Ukraine. 50-year-old Kurt Grosjans and a Ukrainian woman are accused in an assassination plot of a Ukrainian minister. Grosjans has had business dealings with Roman Lyshenko, the current agrarian policy and food minister, and the intended target of the alleged murder plot. The State Department says it is aware of the detention of a U.S. citizen abroad and takes such reports seriously. Grosjans grew up near Ashley in south-central North Dakota and attended NDSU. A media report in Ukraine says Grosjans and the woman have been placed in a 60-day pretrial detention. Senator Hovind's office says after hearing from Grosjans' family and friends, it contacted the State Department to ensure his well-being and that he is being provided with the appropriate due process. A new statewide strategy launched by North Dakota Game and Fish will team landowners, conservation groups, scientists, and others to restore, enhance, and sustain native grasslands in North Dakota. It's called Meadowlark Initiative. Game and Fish Conservation and Communications Chief Greg Link says the idea came about because the state has lost more than 70% of its native prairie.
Really, that is the ultimate buffet for a lot of those different species.
Link says in most cases, this will help ranchers and producers who have livestock on the prairie.
Cattle are the reason there's grass, and the two of them really take care of each other. And so we need, in order to keep grasslands healthy, we need cattle, we need ranchers, because those grasslands take care of society. They sequestered carbon, they take care of our wildlife, they help water infiltrate, take care of our soil health.
Under the initiative, producers can plant marginal cropland back to native grasslands for grazing. Cost shares will be available for installing fencing and water. Producers can also qualify for rental payments as the land transfers from cropland to grazing land. And 9 more North Dakota residents have passed away with COVID-19. According to the State Health Department's coronavirus dashboard, this brings the state's death toll to 1,861. 672 individuals from 49 counties have also tested positive. Today's results are from a batch of 8,224 tests for a daily positive rate of 8.78%. There are currently 3,037 active confirmed cases statewide. 201 cases were confirmed in Cass County, 75 in Burley County, and 48 in Grand Forks County. A detailed map of all new cases from each county is posted on our news page at news.prairiepublic.org. 160 people are currently hospitalized, and since yesterday, 499 people have recovered. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. An indicator species is one that we can look to give us clues about the health of the environment. And birds tend to make a great indicator species. In this week's Natural North Dakota essay, biologist Chuck Lura takes us to a refuge, the Slade National Wildlife Refuge.
Much of North Dakota is pothole country. And the Missouri Coteau, that band of hills that borders the Missouri River on the east, is prime duck country. Tucked away in Kidder County, a bit south and east of Dawson, North Dakota, is Slade National Wildlife Refuge, which provides important habitat for ducks and other wildlife. Slade National Wildlife Refuge consists of about 3,000 acres of upland prairie interspersed with wetlands and small lakes adjacent to Lake Isabel. As you might expect, it contains important nesting habitat for a wide range of birds, particularly waterfowl and shorebirds during the nesting season, as well as during the spring and fall migrations. That includes the threatened piping plover, which is known to nest on the refuge. The prairie also supports a diverse assemblage of birds, such as upland sandpipers, chestnut-collared longspurs, bairds, and LeConte sparrows. Well over 200 species of birds can be observed on the refuge during the course of a year. This refuge has an interesting history. Dawson, North Dakota, located between Steele and Tappan on the Northern Pacific Railway just off I-94 in Kidder County, was established in 1880. Due to abundant wetlands, it quickly became a destination for hunting, particularly for waterfowl. In the early 1900s, those hunters included George T. Slade, a Yale-educated son-in-law of James J. Hill. He became hooked on the area. By the 1920s, Slade began to buy up property adjacent to Lake Isabel, where he established a hunting lodge. Slade became heavily involved with the passage of the Migratory Bird Conservation Act of 1929. About that same time, Frederick Lincoln, head of the U.S. Bird Banding Project, initiated an intensive duck banding effort on Slade's property near Dawson. The data collected was sufficient to help biologists begin to understand the populations and movements of waterfowl. Today, of course, with the help of hunters, banding waterfowl remains an important source of information for waterfowl managers in North America. Upon Slade's death in 1941, he left his Dawson Hunting Lodge property to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to become a refuge for wildlife. If you're interested in checking out Slade National Wildlife Refuge, it's located about 3 miles south and a half mile east of Dawson on the east side of Lake Isabel. There are no facilities on the refuge, with the management under the umbrella of the Long Lake National Wildlife Refuge near Moffett. For more information, check the refuge's website. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. Subscribe to the podcast or find past episodes at prairiepublic.org.
on Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
I don't think they ever thought they were sending their children off to die.
They stripped them of culture. They just became a number.
The white man wanted you to learn his way.
I want everybody to know what happened to our children in those boarding schools.
Right away, I knew I had to go.
I heard a lot of stories about it. I want to see it for myself.
We believe that we can't move forward until all of our ancestors are back home with us.
Watch Independent Lands, Home from School, The Children of Carlisle, tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and I want to read a headline to you right now. Hedge fund known for cutting journalism jobs bids for company that owns Bismarck Tribune. We are going to talk about the potential impacts of that with Steve Andrist, the former executive director of the North Dakota Newspaper Association, a longtime newspaper man, now retired, but in the way that a newsman retires. In that, you know, maybe he's just wearing jeans to work and still very involved in the world of journalism. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
You're sure welcome. Happy to be here.
So let's start with the company that owns the Bismarck Tribune, Lee Enterprises. They own about 100 newspapers around the country, including a couple dozen around the Midwest, and of course, including the Bismarck Tribune. What do you know about Lee Enterprises?
Well, I know quite a bit about Lee Enterprises. I actually was an employee of the Bismarck Tribune back in the 70s when Lee Enterprises bought the Bismarck Tribune. But Lee Enterprises has been primarily a newspaper company, kind of grew up out of in Iowa, and has grown quite a bit over the past number of years, and has been kind of in and out of different ventures in different ways. And one of the things that they're most highly, they have a lot of newspapers, as you mentioned. And one of the other things they're really big into right now is the digital presence that they can inject into their newspapers. And they have, I think, a couple of subsidiaries that are doing a lot of that sort of work on behalf of the newspaper members that they have. And Lee does have quite a strong presence in the Midwest. I think the Bismarck is the only one in North Dakota, and they do have Rapid City in South Dakota, but there are several in places like Montana and
The Billings Gazette.
Nebraska. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the Winona Daily News in Minnesota. So this region in particular could be quite impacted by this. What would a hedge fund want to do with a newspaper? These people are not journalists.
Well, that's a very interesting question. And my perspective, just from being an industry observer, is that a hedge fund is not particularly interested in newspapers or journalism. They're interested in profits.
Yep.
So, and of course, what company isn't? But the reason they got into newspapers, I think, is they found that they were the advent of digital news information or digital information dissemination has impacted newspapers. And I think companies like Alden Global, which is the one we're talking about today, found that by acquiring newspapers that are maybe feeling a financial pinch for one reason or another, they could acquire them fairly reasonably and grab some quick profits by cutting expenses as significantly as they possibly can. And in large part, the experience that people have seen, I think, is that cutting expenses has translated into cutting journalists. So I don't really understand the financial or the business implications of what they're doing, but I do understand what it's doing in a lot of communities as far as the newspaper world and the world of journalism as newspapers, even print newspapers transition to digital in a lot of cases. It's changing that world quite a bit.
Why do news consumers need to care about this possible acquisition?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I can tell you my my take on that is that we know over the past 5 years or so, there have been a number of studies about journalism and specifically newspapers and what happens to communities when they lose their newspaper or when they lose local journalism. And none of the things that happen as a result of that are good. We see a decline in civic engagement. We see a decline in the number of people running for public office. We see divisions in communities because there is no longer an objective observer in those communities. We've even seen a lot of evidence in some communities that that it increases the cost of local government when they lose a newspaper or lose journalism because there is no sort of watchdog in those communities anymore, and therefore even little things like the cost of insurance goes up because, you know, there's more chances for untoward things to happen when there's nobody watching to see what's happening. So all of those things, but I think mostly the civic engagement is a big deal because that's really what holds a community together. It's really it's what makes it a community as opposed to a conglomeration of a bunch of people.
So if anyone is concerned, though, and maybe even on a community level, maybe even on a state level, though, I mean, this is a private business wanting to sell to another private business. Is there any thing that stands in between, and it's not fully gone through yet, but this hedge fund is offering a 30% premium over the company's closing stock, and that's a pretty tough offer to walk away from. But, you know, yeah. If somebody is concerned, is there anything that they can even do at this point?
I mean, I don't think so. I think this is the market at work. It may be considered a hostile takeover, but nevertheless, when somebody comes to you and says, I'm willing to pay you $25 for something that's worth $20, you don't usually turn them down.
Yeah.
And I think boards of directors of company like Lee would be hard-pressed to say that it's in the interest of their shareholders, which is who they represent, to reject an offer like that. And some of the other cases where Alden Capital has or Alden Global has purchased newspaper groups, there have been efforts by competing groups to attempt to step in, and there have been serious considerations of accepting a lesser offer just because of what happens when that journalism disappears even faster. But, you know, those boards of directors have a fiduciary interest to their stockholders, to their shareholders, and it's, I'm not aware of any cases in which an effort to maintain the status quo in some way has been successful. There's not much you can do. I can dream.
Yeah. Have you been in this position where somebody offered you $25 for something that was worth $20?
I'd like to be. But I don't have anything that that has that kind of value. But no, personally, I haven't been in that position. I ran a community newspaper company for 21 plus years, and it's a lot different. That's kind of a local business, so it's not Lee Enterprise, as you said. I don't remember the number you said, but has 100 and some newspapers in various communities, that's a much different ballgame than a community newspaper in a couple of small towns of North Dakota.
We're visiting today with Steve Andrus, the former executive director of the North Dakota Newspaper Association, about a hedge fund that has put in an offer to purchase Lee Enterprises, which owns the Bismarck Tribune, along with nearly 100 other newspapers around the country, including the Rapid City Journal in South Dakota and the Billings Gazette in Montana and the Winona Daily News in Minnesota. So certainly some regional impact on newspapers here. Let's talk about the newspaper industry a little bit more generically here, because it's interesting that you hear a hedge fund wanting to maybe come in and purchase this, with their interest being in money. And then so often you also hear, well, newspapers, that's a dying industry. So let's start there. Are newspapers a dying industry?
Sure, we can start. Yeah, that's an interesting question. There's been a sea change in the newspaper industry, as everyone knows and everyone can imagine. And the number of newspapers across the country has significantly declined. And the number of what we call news deserts has significantly increased. And fortunately, in North Dakota, we've avoided a lot of that, which is a kind of a benefit of living in a small rural state, I think. But we can look across North Dakota and across the country and see a lot of promise left in local newspapers. And the promise, probably there's still some promise in larger metro newspapers as well. But it's almost like you have to be willing to reinvent yourself. In the small towns of North Dakota, newspapers are community glue. They're what holds the community together. But more and more social media is taking over. The thing that, from my perspective at least, that has impacted the newspaper industry in this country the most is that newspapers were always driven by advertising revenue. And in many cases, they were the only place where you could get advertising in some communities. In bigger communities, they were the primary one. They're a legacy media for a reason. They dominated that marketplace, and that's where the exchange of information and ideas took place in communities. But then the digital age came in, and larger companies like Facebook and Google and Amazon and blogs and places like that started providing different options for people to get their commercial messages out, their advertising messages out, and that was the new, the newfangled, fancy new thing that attracts a lot of interest and attention. And the result of that was that the bread and butter revenues that supported newspapers for many years were diverted away from newspapers and into these other industries that don't provide journalism. They maybe provide an opportunity for people to transfer information, but they don't normally provide journalism. And journalism, to me, is the key, mm-hmm. because that's where you get something that's not, it's vetted, multi-sourced information that covers various perspectives of an issue in one story, as opposed to, what we see mostly on social media type things, mm-hmm. is people sharing information that they already hold as true, and even if it's not.
Right. What you want to be true and what is actually true are not forcibly the same
right.
thing. Stephen, talking about this loss of advertising dollars, though, and this competition with these huge companies, is there an argument to be made that having a hedge fund own a newspaper brings with it deeper pockets that could facilitate the transition more easily to competing in the digital space?
Well, I have read in a couple of different instances, and we're talking about Alden Capital here today, that their point of view is that they have come in and purchased and restructured newspaper companies that were hurting, and they've extended the lives of those newspaper companies. by doing that. So I think that's the argument that they would make, is that those deeper pockets have at the very least kept newspapers operating. The other side of it is those newspapers are operating at a sliver of what their former lives. Their page counts are down, their story counts are down, their number of journalists are down. And you can see that exactly is what happened when they bought the Tribune Company, which included some pretty significant newspapers like the Chicago Tribune and the mm-hmm. iconic Chicago Tribune building in downtown. And the number of journalists at many of those papers declined 20-30% pretty quickly after that was purchased. So, you know, and maybe in some cases they were able to keep the newspapers from closing completely. That's arguable. But in all of the cases, I think the practice of journalism has taken a big hit.
We want to have you on, Steve, in the future for a longer conversation here. But you mentioned before we started recording that you are working on something about increasing the strength of nonprofit journalism in this region. Can you give us a little teaser about what you see as that ray of hope?
Well, and that's why this news about Alden making a bid for Lee Enterprises is concerning to me, because in the last year or so, we've had a group of people that has actually formed and incorporated as a nonprofit an entity to provide more journalism in North Dakota. It's actually called the North Dakota News Co-op, and it's registered now, has a board of directors. It was started by newspaper people in the state, but there are a number of non-newspaper people who value journalism who are also on it. There's kind of a two-pronged point to this group. The first one is simply to be able to raise some charitable giving. Not that we want to compete with public radio, but but to be we want to both exist profitably and strongly. But the idea is that we would be able to hire maybe a couple of journalists who could write more detailed stories for use by media in North Dakota as they see fit. So that would bring some of that journalism back into, it would replace some of the journalism that we've already lost. Unfortunately, now we're with the Lee Enterprises offer, we're also looking at I fear that we potentially will lose more journalism in the state. So, you know, it's two steps forward and two steps backward. But we're still charging ahead with that. It's kind of an interesting idea, and hopefully it's going to be successful.
Well, we look forward to learning more about that in the future. Steve Andrus, the former executive director of the North Dakota Newspaper Association, thank you so much for your time today.
You're most welcome. Good talking with you.
Dakota Day Book is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by United Way of Cass Clay, bringing our community together, lifting families out of poverty, and creating a better tomorrow for all of us. When we believe united, we succeed united. Learn more at UnitedWayCassClay.org.
This is Dakota Day Book for November 23rd. On this date in 1912, it was announced that a fabulous Bismarck home was nearing completion. The final cost of the home belonging to Attorney General Miller would amount to the princely sum of $6,000. It was designed and built by noted local contractor N.A. Freeburg. He and his partner, Charles Kidd, were responsible for several prominent buildings in Bismarck and Mandan, including the First National Bank in Mandan, the Stuart Dunlap House, and the Esser House. The Stuart Dunlap House was one of their earliest buildings. Located on 7th Avenue in Mandan, it was built in 1904. It's a fine example of Queen Anne architecture. The residence and the accompanying carriage house were placed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1992. The register entry notes that the property embodies the distinctive characteristics of a type period, or method of construction, or represents the work of a master, or possesses high artistic values. Freeburg designed and built the home for Stuart Dunlap, the original owner. Dunlap was a conductor on the Northern Pacific Railroad. The Dunlaps, their six children, and their housekeepers lived in the house for 10 years. Dunlap originally requested a rectangular wraparound porch on the south and east sides of the house. When he saw a house with a curved porch, he was inspired to alter the design. His change resulted in a sweeping porch with a graceful curve. The maids' quarters were on the second floor, with the servants' staircase at the back of the house that went directly to the kitchen and pantry. A weather vane powered a pump that filled the upstairs water supply tank. The house is known by the name of the original owner, but is primarily associated with a later owner. In 1923, Hoy Sylvester Russell, founder of the Mandan Creamery and Produce Company, purchased the home. He and his wife Cora raised their family there. The Mandan Creamery and Produce Company is now known as Cloverdale Foods. After the death of her husband, Cora Russell continued to live in the house until 1971. The current owner restored the home to its original grandeur and has furnished it appropriately for the Victorian era. The adjacent carriage house is also original. It's possible to schedule a tour of the Stuart Dunlap House by contacting the Mandan Historical Society. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
You love hearing the little birdie, followed by a great story. Now read all about it again. Dakota Datebook, North Dakota Stories from Prairie Public, Volume 2 is out, and if you order now, you'll get it in time for the holidays. Meet Mustache Maud, the only woman convicted of cattle rustling in the United States. Learn about the whale that made its way across this very landlocked state. Read about homesteaders, earthquakes, meteors, crazy capers, and misguided criminals, and much more. It's our state's colorful and untold history in one beautifully laid out collection. Order the new book, Dakota Datebook, North Dakota Stories from Prairie Public, Volume 2, for $24.95 each at prairiepublic.org.
A tale written in the 19th century tells a story of an Afghan refugee and his unique friendship with a little girl in India.
I read Kabuliwala in school and I remember bawling like a baby.
A story with themes that still resonate today.
It reminds you that the person who's coming to your country is a human being like you're a human being.
On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
There's 5 hours of Morning Edition every weekday here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, performances are multi-sensory, multifaceted experiences. And we talk to the muralist behind the Concordia Christmas Concert, a much-loved concert in this region. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.